On this week's 51%, an historian talks about women's roles in shaping civilization and her BBC documentary on the subject.
Brawn no longer counts for anything, actually. It's brains. And in the brains economy, men and women are on an equal playing field.
And we meet a woman with a nose for memory. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Award-winning historian Dr. Amanda Foreman argues that a history that pushes women to the margins is an untruth that must be challenged. To this end, she created the four-part documentary series The Ascent of Woman with the BBC. Lauren Schiller of Inflection Point spoke with Dr. Foreman about the role that women have really played in shaping our civilization.
The Ascent of Woman is a new documentary, not to be confused with The Ascent of Man from the BBC in 1973. Or even The Scent of a Woman, starring Al Pacino in 1992. The Ascent of Woman is a four-part series, also produced by the BBC, and available on Netflix. It covers 10,000 years of history. Written and presented by historian, journalist, and author Dr. Amanda Foreman, it is the first documentary to present the history of women from the dawn of civilization to the modern day. Dr. Foreman argues that a history that pushes women to the margins, maybe like the one you learn about in school, is an untruth that must be challenged. Welcome, Amanda.
Hello, Lauren.
What misconceptions were you trying to change with this series?
The biggest misconception that we wanted to tear down was the idea that women have always been on the margins of history, that civilization happened while women were sitting in the kitchen, twiddling their thumbs, or perhaps stirring at the stove, but essentially sitting there passively waiting to be called to the table to sit down with the adults.
Why do these misconceptions exist?
Well, one of the reasons is because for nearly 2,000 years, writing and scholarship was captured by a male elite who systematically excluded women from scholarship, from writing, from the ability to use writing and knowledge as a means of self-expression. And they cornered the history market, and they wrote history from their perspective, their viewpoint, their wants, their wishes, the way they would like the world to be. And that viewpoint was specifically male.
And do you feel that this was intentional, or somehow they just didn't explore the role of women as they were looking back at history?
I don't believe that there is a conspiracy out there. I don't believe that there's malice or some kind of a forethought that drives men to systematically and purposefully keep women out. But if you ever go to any kind of gathering, you'll often notice that the gatherings become gendered spaces anyway. The women will generally start talking to one another. The men will generally start talking to one another. And there's nothing wrong with that. Men and women often will have different concerns and may end up chatting to each other in a gendered space. So I don't think it was an inorganic or even particularly evil intent that created this gender separation. But it happened, and once it happened, it suited men to be in charge and to exclude women and to discount the actions of women. And that's how I think it went from being a small issue to a major issue.
Well, my understanding is that even history departments today are very male-dominated, and that it is very difficult as a woman to have your voice heard, to have your writings published. Has that been your experience or your observation?
Well, what you've highlighted is another aspect of the difficulty, which is that most universities, in fact, they favor male academics not because they don't like women, but because their hiring practices favor men who have a spouse at home who will take care of the domestic work and have the children and rear them up and take over that whole other aspect of life, which then allows the male academic to have a heavy course load and a heavy research load and write and publish loads of books. It's really difficult for women to get enough maternity leave in order to do everything that they want to do with their children and their families, and also be an academic and write books. And that is what makes it so difficult for women in academia. It's the system that's against them.
Well, you share in the documentary that there was a time way back in 8,000 BC in Turkey that was completely egalitarian in terms of both gender and class. But that all changed. Can you describe what that looked like and what happened to overturn that situation?
Yes, it's very interesting because we as a human race have always been fascinated by origins, and it was believed that it was simply agriculture itself that fostered inequality and class and segregation between the sexes. And then Çatalhöyük was discovered in Anatolia, which was this settlement that had 8,000 people living in it, a really substantial, this isn't just 200 people living in some mud huts. This was a substantial, thriving town. And when archaeologists began to really do some very careful digging, they discovered that the bones showed that men and women did the same kinds of work. They had the same wear and tear on their bodies. They had the same kind of diets. They operated in the same space. What that means, for example, is that if you look at soot deposits on these bones, they are roughly the same, which means that they sat around the fire at the same distance, which is key for understanding segregated and gendered space. And then, of course, they are buried in the same manner. So they weren't differentiated in terms of status with the goods or ways or that they were interred. And this is an amazing idea that at the dawn of civilization, men and women lived in this egalitarian way. So what, then you ask, so what happened? Well, what happens is that when you have more than one settlement, you have two or three or four, and you have competition for resources and allocations between them, you start to get a more militarized society. And it's the militarization more than simply agriculture and accumulation of surplus that leads to a male-dominated hierarchy. And that's what you get in Mesopotamia, which is the cradle of civilization, the Fertile Crescent in what is now war-torn Iraq, where you get the first cities constantly warring against each other, electing generals to defend them and then to lead them in attacks against neighboring cities. And then those generals set up kingships. And those kingships are hereditary. And generally, you're now looking at, you know, a male hierarchy.
Why are women so vulnerable in when that happens, rather than the men who are also being conquered?
Well, I don't believe that biology determines destiny, but biology definitely plays a huge role. And it is simply unlikely that if you're 8 or 9 months pregnant, you're going to be out there riding a horse, throwing a spear at your enemy. And if that's the case, then you're going to see a dichotomy in warring societies between those who stay at home to run things, organize things, look after the family, look after the estates, and those who are out there making war. But what we mistake in all this is even if there's a hierarchy based on male violence and the kinds of advantages that can accrue through violence, that doesn't mean that that's the only metric of power that these ancient civilizations observe. That there's way too much obsessive interest about spears and arrowheads and things made of bronze, and not nearly enough interest on textiles. You know, when we talk about the Silk Road, what we're saying is that the whole economy of Asia was determined by the thing that women made. If anything made, anything that made China rich can be pinpointed at, it is the work of women, textiles and silk weaving. And it's the same in Mesopotamia. When we talk about trade, we're talking about the trading of textiles And that was something that women did. So when you're trying to put women back into history, that's the kind of history that we wanted to, and I wanted to show, was that it isn't simply about a battle. It's not simply about war, and it's not simply about what one man could do leading an army, because that man and that army is absolutely nothing without the economic and labor input of the city that he is leading, and that input is done by women.
Well, it seems like the military might has been to the detriment of women, in spite of all of the contributions that the women are making to the economy. Do you think that with women taking greater roles in the military today, that this narrative could change, that the things that we hold sacred and that give weight to, like the making of the textiles, could change?
Yes, I think so very much, that we live in a completely different world from our ancestors, that brawn no longer counts for anything, actually. It's brains. And in the brains economy, men and women are on an equal playing field. It absolutely means nothing about how far you can throw something or lift something or how fast you can run. I mean, sure, there's some advantages to that in a very few situations. But that's why places like Africa can leapfrog over some of the trials and tribulations that other countries have had to go through in the course towards equality, because, you know, women can set up their own micro-businesses and they don't need to worry about institutional gender hostility from banks or credit card companies or anything like that. They can just get a mobile phone and start trading. and so there's a kind of new liberty that the internet and the digital age is opening up for previously marginalized communities, of which women have been the biggest.
But I can't help but wonder, this idea of when there are resources and when there is prosperity, that there is competition. And then when there is competition, ultimately there can be differences in equality. And when there's differences in equality, ultimately someone wants to take it all. And so is this idea, I mean, maybe this is a long shot here, but just the question of capitalism and every person for themselves, does that actually work against the possibilities for equality, or does it enhance?
Well, that's why we have laws, actually, because human beings are fallible, and we are a bundle of good and bad natures. And some of that can be taught out of us and socialized out of us. You know, we're taught to play nicely with others. We're taught to share. We're taught to have a sense of community feeling and to volunteer. And these are customs, some of which are very close to human nature anyway, because, you know, humans are social animals, and some of which has to be learned behavior. So, for example, we no longer chop people's arms and legs off when we punish them, although we did that routinely 300 years ago for sport. And everybody gathered in the market square to watch as, you know, some local criminal was tortured to death. And we don't do that anymore. So we're always striving towards a kind of better version of ourselves. But since we're always destined to fail, we have laws to help keep us on the straight and narrow. And so what Adam Smith believed is that it's a combination of law and human nature working together that helps to produce, you know, a better self-improving society, even though that society is always going to be facing these challenges. There's never going to be a state of perfection.
Well, let's talk about the book you've got coming out.
Yes. Well, I have to say, I wish I was writing it faster.
Well, you're only covering, what, a million years of history? How far back, yes, are you going?
Yeah, that's right. I am actually. I'm going back 5 million years, because what I'm really interested in is the origin stories that we tell ourselves. And one of the biggest origin stories is this idea that it was men who made the leap from simply swinging from the trees to, in, you know, living in settled communities. And so if you go to any natural history museum, you look at those dioramas and things, what you see is a story where there's a bunch of hairy individuals, and the female hairy individuals are sitting around a fire, you know, roasting something with some children playing nearby. And then the male hairy individuals are out there attacking some woolly mammoth. And that accompanying that picture is the story of, well, it was men who went out to get meat. And of course, it was the meat content that made our brains get stronger and cleverer and bigger. And because they had to use weapons to bring down these scary animals, they started to use tools, and it was tools that led to scientific thinking. And because they had to cooperate to bring down these animals and bring them back, that led to the first sense of community, and that led to the development of language. So men created absolutely everything to do with civilization, and aren't we women lucky to have had them? Well, that actually is just a story. It is no more grounded in science than this other story I'm not going to tell you. And in this story, what fostered the sense of community and connectedness, in fact, is women giving birth and having children, because it's the release of oxytocin, the tend and befriend hormone, that before there's language, before there's anything, fosters that sense of human connection with others. And it began with mothers bonding with their children, and then mothers and children bonding with grandmothers, which again fosters a sense of cooperation. The mother goes off to gather, the grandmother stays to look after the children, which is why we are the only species which has a long life after menopause, that we have a function that continues long after we are still sexually reproductive. So communication and then language came from mothers and babbling and cooing to their children. That is the first form of communication, is between mothers and babies. It is not between men talking about, shall we share the mammoth tonight? So I can give you a completely alternate view. And those tools that we're talking about, those clever arrowheads, well, before there were clever arrowheads, there were clever digging tools and digging sticks for getting those all-important roots out of the ground that were the first important source of food and nutrients, even way before they were eating cold, uncooked, stringy meat that was difficult to chew and digest.
Well, Amanda, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
That was Dr. Amanda Forman talking about her BBC documentary, The Ascent of Woman. She was speaking with Lauren Schiller, host of Inflection Point, produced at KALW.
Llévelo usted, señorito, que no vale más que un real. Cómpreme usted este ramito, cómpreme usted este ramito, pa' lucirlo en el ojal.
We actually will talk about The Scent of a Woman, but not the Al Pacino film. Maybe I'm just waxing sentimental about summer fading away here in the Northeast, but this next piece reminds me of when I was a little girl, eager to fill every summer moment with doing anything outside. One of my infrequent but obviously memorable endeavors was to make homemade perfume by filling a jar with water and picking everything from a garden flower to a weed to make that oh-so-imperfect summer scent that ended up down the drain or recycled back onto the lawn. Smell is a catalyst for memories. But for Antonia Belanca, smell is an art form. Shelby El Otmani has the story from Osterville, Massachusetts.
Antonia Belanca has a nose for memory.
I can remember as if it were yesterday. Like right now, when I say to you, when I just started that sentence, I imagined the roses in my grandmother's garden and the sweet peas, and I can recreate the fragrance in my head.
Antonia doesn't just remember these smells from her past. She transforms those smells into perfumes. Her line is called Antonia's Flowers, and each perfume is associated with memories or experiences from her life, like her grandmother's garden or days by the sea. But how on earth do you turn a memory or the smell of a memory into a perfume? Well, it begins with flowers. Antonia discovered her passion for scent in her flower shop when she realized that her favorite thing about flowers wasn't really the flowers.
I mean, sometimes I'd have just almost unsalable, you know, lilies that were all blown open already, but they smelled so good that, you know, like that I would buy them. And then I was like, wow, this is really what I love about flowers.
For Antonia, smell is key. But the funny thing is, she didn't even wear perfume at that point.
And when I went to look for something to wear, there was nothing that appealed to me. It was all this kind of old lady, dusty, musty kind of look.
So she decided to make her own. And she wanted it to smell just like her flower shop, just like Freesia. First, she had to meet with a perfumer, someone who could mix the fragrance for her.
I went to the flower market and got this giant bunch of Freesia and was in the elevator going up to the labs and the sales floor. And everybody in the elevator looked at me like I was a crazy person walking in with a bouquet of flowers to show them what I wanted. Because it was just, that wasn't the way you made fragrances.
This was the 80s. And back then, perfume was meant to evoke the idea of a thing, not smell like the thing itself. It's extremely difficult to make a fragrance that mimics nature. But Antonia was determined, and with a little help, she found a new perfumer who also wanted floral perfume to smell like actual flowers. So he mixed one up.
I felt really happy in it, and then when I wore it, you know, the response was precisely what you dream of.
Still, something was slightly off.
I knew that the first smell out of the bottle wasn't so good.
In the perfume world, the first smell out of the bottle is known as the top note. So Antonia went to the perfumer to change it.
But he didn't quite know how to tell me that with this fragrance, there was no way to modify the top note without changing everything about the whole fragrance. Here, we're going to bring them all over. We'll open. We're going to do a floret. You know what? We'll open a couple. It was just totally cool.
That's the thing about perfume. Sometimes a scent simply can't exist because the chemistry just isn't there.
It's too aroca.
That can mean sacrificing the accuracy in smell for the longevity and stability of the perfume.
Do the original.
And that's a challenge Antonia faces every time she makes a new fragrance, because the scent may never match the exact smell from her memory.
And we'll see how far we get.
Despite that top note, her first fragrance smells almost exactly like a bunch of freesia, as if you had spent your entire day in a flower shop.
Oh my God, that's... It reminds you of your shop?
Oh yeah. Oh, like, absolutely. Like, it brings back everything of my shop.
Sometimes Antonia doesn't even try to use memory as inspiration for a fragrance. It just happens. Take one of her newer fragrances. She told her perfumer she wanted something earthy and like you'd been wearing it all night at a party. And when she smelled it for the first time, something totally unpredictable happened. It reminded her, somehow, of her grandfather.
My grandfather was very, very special in my life. I'll start to cry when I talk about him. But he was really a special guy. He was a barber, he was a musician, and he was a music teacher. The barbershop would be filled with people listening to the opera live from the Met. Chickens were in the back. You know, he was giving music lessons in the back of the shop and also, you know, live with opera. It was a gathering place there for everybody to come listen.
She named it Tiempo Pasado after a love ballad her grandfather wrote in the 1920s. You're listening to it now. Tiempo pasado que el antiguo amor. Antonia has made 5 fragrances since 1984. She doesn't have any new ones in the works at the moment, and she won't create a new perfume until the right moment strikes. So she lives, nose at the ready, waiting for the next memory worth bottling. In Osterville, Massachusetts, I'm Shelby Elitmani.
You can learn more about Antonia's perfume at antoniasflowers.com. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1418.